Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the studios of KSFR and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. So this is the last day in our opera series. It's the last of our five Mondays. I'd like to welcome Desiree Mays. She is an international storyteller and lecturer on opera and the author of Opera Unveiled, which accompanies the Santa Fe Opera season every year. She speaks nightly at the Santa Fe Opera during the season. And this year, the season opens on June 27th. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe once again.
Hello, Mary Charlotte.
And today we're talking about Radamisto by Händel. Do we say Georg Friedrich Händel or do we say George Frederick Händel?
Well, you can actually say both, since he was both.
He was English and German. And,
well, he came from Hanover and he worked for the Elector of Hanover. And then he decided he wanted to go to England to test the waters there for his Baroque opera. And he was such a roaring success that he stayed in England. And then, lo and behold, Queen Anne died. And the Elector, whom he had abandoned, I mean, his job was to make music for the Elector of Hanover, was elected George I of England, to Handel's consternation. So, there was a dark cloud when the new king arrived. And you know what he did? He wrote the water music. The king decided he wanted some music to accompany his entourage down the Thames one evening. The weather must have been better in those days to go out at midnight on the Thames. and he didn't know who the composer was. He said, "This music is wonderful. I want it played two or three." So they're cruising up and down the Thames.
That's so operatic, really.
Yes, it is.
I mean, it's
a
real-life story, but you trick the king into putting you back
into his favor, exactly.
By playing music that he loves so much that he has it played over and over again, and he says, "Oh, why, it's Handel.
And it's Handel.
I was mad at, but I'm not mad at him anymore."
No, big kiss, hug, and then Handel decided that he would dedicate this opera to the king, which was another good PR move, I suppose.
So Radamisto, first of all, we're talking about Baroque opera, and we talked about Baroque opera last year with Platé. Baroque opera is a whole different thing than Verdi or Mozart or any of the modern operas. And one thing is, it seems to be based on mythological and ancient Greek or Roman themes?
Yes. Originally it was. This comes in the early years of opera. Opera started in about 1600, and we are now talking 1720. So it's just making inroads into the world of the arts, and we're dealing with audiences who are of the nobility, who were well-educated in myth, and gods and goddesses were the subjects of choice. Greek myth, Orpheus and Eurydice was the original opera, Daphne. Were the first operas. So this tradition is still going on in Handel's time, and it came to be called Baroque opera because by now there's a very clear form emerging from the very early, embryonic stages of opera, where there is, it's highly structured. There are conversational bits called recitatives, where the people talk to one another and advance the plot. That recitative tradition continued well on into the 20th century, actually. And then there would be arias and very little ensembles, very few duets or trios or everything that came later, like Verdi, whose great Falstaff is an ensemble piece. Here you mainly get solos, and not just solos, but a character would come on stage, sing what he or she was feeling about, and then walk off stage, regardless of whether it fitted the action or not. These were called exit arias. You'd do your thing and you'd leave to rapturous applause, if you will. If you were lucky. But the style was structured, and it was the rage of London. London was actually the center of the operatic world in the 1720s because of this Baroque style and because of Handel. Handel would be sent to Europe to contract artists. Some things don't change. I mean, our general directors do the same thing now. They go all over the world contracting artists. But in this case, Handel was contracting mainly castrati. who these were the singers of choice at the time, the big names, and sopranos to join the Royal Academy at London and make up his company for these operas. He produced many, many operas in the Baroque style. There was 10 glorious years where they were wildly popular. People flocked to these operas. And then they fell out of fashion. London society was pretty fickle in those days, and they came to call the castrati aberrations of nature, and the whole thing fell out of style, and it ended. But while it was great, it was truly great. And now, in our time, these operas are beginning to really appeal to people again. When I was a child, I remember going to Handel operas, and it could be pretty dull because the arias would go on, and the singer would literally stand in the middle of the stage, look at the conductor, and sing. There was very little action. This has changed, and for the better, I think, because when Handel was composing all this music, spectacle was very important. So they really went to town with spectacle. I mean, there were fantastic sets and costumes, and things were happening. Directors today are doing the same thing. They're bringing back this sense of spectacle.
So are you saying that the operas, the way they're presented now, are more like the way they were presented during the Baroque?
Perhaps, yes. And then I don't know what happened, but people stopped doing the production, end of it. In the Radamisto that we are presenting here at the Santa Fe Opera, the director is David Alden. He's a wonderfully colorful, imaginative director. He set it in the right time, in the time of the original piece, which is about 51 AD, Middle East, Armenia, loosely. But it's done with fantastic color. And at one point, there's an enormous mural with those brilliant colors of Persia and Persian costumes throughout. At one point, all that goes away and there's nothing but mirrored walls and floor. I mean, that'll be spectacular at the Santa Fe Opera in that night sky. The whole thing will be mirrored. There are giant images of an elephant and a tiger, and those Middle Eastern emblems and symbols that were there. So there'll be lots to look at and listen for, and a lot of action, because today our singers, though they may be Baroque, and there's no way they can just stand and sing. They have to get into the action, and there'll be a lot of action.
Let's set up the story in preparation for our first musical excerpt.
Yeah, that's not easy to do because the greatest storytellers have troubles with this opera. It's very convoluted. But it is, I suppose, about two magnificent women who are called Zenobia and Polissena. They both are passionately in love with their husbands. Zenobia is married to Radamisto, who returns her love. Theirs is a true love story. And Polissena is in love with Tiridate, who is a king, who is in love with Zenobia. I don't want to lose you at this point, but this is what happens.
Basically, Zenobia's husband and Polissena's husband are both in love with Zenobia.
Yes, that's right.
And so she has her husband, which is the true love, and then this other guy who basically ruins the lives of
everyone. He's a tyrant. Everyone. He's an absolute tyrant. He does what he wants when he wants it.
So he basically, what did he, firebombs her whole city?
Yeah, he does. He wrecks the city of Thrace to kill the king and the son Radamisto just to nab the woman.
Who doesn't even want him in the first place
because
she's in love with her husband.
Yes. This whole thing comes from a wonderful little tiny snippet of a story from Tacitus in the Annals of Imperial Rome, where Radamisto's city has been sacked and he and his wife are escaping on horseback. The only problem is she is very pregnant, and she says to him, Radamisto, I can't make it, I'm pregnant, you have to kill me. I don't want to fall into the hands of the tyrant king, Tiridate. And he's not able to do it. So she jumps in the river and she's assumed drowned. She does later, she's rescued and brought to the court. So that's the germ of the source of this story.
Yeah.
And that actually shows up in the second act. She begs her husband. Well, we'll get to that. It's actually it's part of this first section I'd like to play for you. Zenobia in this recording is Maite Beaumont, and she sings a two-line cavatina. So this is a sort of a mini aria that goes on, and she's bemoaning how terrible things are, they're having to escape the city, and then it goes into this recitative, and I think you'll hear quite clearly the shift from the musical aria into the conversation with her husband, though it's a little confusing because the husband, Radamisto, is sung by a soprano.
Now, do you want to just tell us what a recitative.
The recitative, is the conversational bit. It's where the characters talk to one another. It's where the plot is advanced. And in this case, they say they're escaping from the city, and Radamisto says, "I see the enemy pursuing us. What are we to do?" And she said, "There's only one thing to do. You must kill me, Radamisto. I don't want to fall into the hands of the enemy." And he says, "No, I can't do it." So that's the dialogue that's going on at the end of this piece. And you'll hear it. It's very easy to pick up because there's no melodic accompaniment to a recitative. It's usually just the singers doing singing simply with the occasional chord from the harpsichord.
And what's the language?
The language is, of course, Italian in this case. So let's hear part of Zenobia's aria at the beginning, her cavatina, and it then goes into the recitative, the dialogue with Radamisto. And that was part of Zenobia's aria from Radamisto by Handel, right from the beginning of the opera. It's lovely, isn't it?
There's something about Baroque music which is like nothing else. It goes into your heart in a way. I can't explain it.
I agree. It's very direct. I think you have to let go of everything else outside. You have to give up. You have to surrender to this music.
And what's funny is it's so emotional and yet it's so mathematical.
Yes, yes, it is. And there was sort of a reason for that in a sense. The musicians at this time believed in the doctrine of the affections. Now, just to backtrack a little on this, whenever there's an aria sung in any of these operas, the character sings about what they're feeling. It doesn't really advance your knowledge of who the character is or what they're about. They just sing about a feeling. In the recitative is the discussion and the dialogue, but then they stop that and they think back on what just has occurred and they sing about the feeling. So they called it the doctrine of the affections, which proposed that music can arouse a variety of specific emotions in the listener. And this was an important component of Baroque style. By making use of the proper procedure, the composer could create a piece of music capable of producing a particular emotional response in the listener. That's amazing if you think about it.
And yet it sounds perfectly plausible to me because, I mean, there's all sorts of ways that music is used mm-hmm. to manipulate your emotions.
Exactly.
And that's not necessarily a bad thing.
And they understood that. The musicians of the Baroque believed if music was the physical embodiment of feelings, moods, and emotions, then one musical idea would be linked to only one emotion. So with that in mind, I'd like to play part of Radamisto's great aria, Ombra Caro, where he believes his wife is dead, he's had to leave her, and he sings to her shade, to her spirit. And you'll hear the mourning. Just listen for that, not who or what the singer is about, because again, this is a woman, Joyce DiDonato, sings Radamisto on this recording, but about the expression of that loss. It's a deep loss, and you just have to let go and imagine yourself in that situation, because it's described beautifully in the music. Part of Radamisto's aria Ombra Caro from Radamisto by Handel. On this recording, we heard Joyce DiDonato. This is a woman singing Radamisto, which is a male role. She's a mezzo. She's one, listeners will remember, she sang Cinderella here just a little while ago. This role, of course, was originally actually written for a soprano, but then it was taken over by a castrato.
I mean, I find this really confusing. I mean,
yes.
This was written by a soprano, written for a soprano, and yet it's the role of the husband. Why didn't they have a guy play the role?
Well, at the time of the Baroque, there were really only two forms of voices, the castrati and sopranos, the famous divas who gave divas a bad name. Their behavior was terrible. So there were these choices, and both were feminine voices. You know, the voice of the castrato was deliberately they were castrated so they could maintain that beautiful high sound of
now,
the boy.
Let's talk about that for a second. You had 8 to 10 year old boys, sometimes a little older, with these beautiful, pure soprano voices, And at the age of 10, they'd cut their balls off.
Yeah, exactly. And this was thanks to the Catholic Church, actually, because the church believed that women should not be allowed to sing in church. There's a line in Corinthians that said, let women not be heard, as is paraphrasing it, be heard in church. So the church fathers wanted to maintain that very beautiful sound of the boy soprano. And the way to do it was to arrange for them to fall off a horse, quote, or have something happen so that their voice would never change, that physiologically they would never make the switch, the voice would never break, it would always have that soprano sound.
And there were thousands of them every year that were castrated.
Yeah, it was devastating. In the 16, 1700s, thousands of young boys were castrated to become singers. It was mainly in Italy that this happened. First of all, they sang
in
church
choirs. The
French
were dead against it.
Yes, they were. They were not happy about this. These boys, first of all, sang in church choirs, and then they began to appear in opera. And these, as they grew to be men, physiologically they were very different. They had the breath, the chest capacity of a man with long bones. For some reason, their bones kept growing long, so they had great breath control. Their training was intense, rigorous, I mean, to the point of cruelty. They sang many, many hours a day. And if they made it, they could become superstars. I mean, in the way we have superstars today, no different. They were highly popular. They were outrageous characters. They really were. People loved them, and they would go to hear them. There's a marvelous movie, Mary Shaw, that everybody should see called Farinelli, and that is the true story of one of the greatest castratos of the period. If you can get over the first 10 minutes where they actually show you the surgery, which is a little rough, but after that, the Italian families, these are maybe peasant families who had no money,
happened to have a talented son.
Child. So it wasn't too hard for them to give up this child to the possibility of a very, very wealthy, successful career.
And your book, we're talking to Desiree Mays, whose book is called Opera Unveiled, and this year's chapter on Radamisto has far more than I ever knew about the castrati. I always figured that they lost their sexuality.
No, they were highly popular, and the fact that they could make love to a woman but never make her pregnant made them very appealing. And that's dealt with in the Farinelli film,
too.
Yeah, exactly. Amazing. You know, it is amazing. You think, well, they had no sex life. That actually was not true.
They were getting it on constantly.
Absolutely, yeah. But Farinelli had a marvelous ending. The King of Spain loved the sound of his voice, and we'll never hear a castrati voice because they died out.
Thank goodness.
Yeah, well, about 1900 was the last castrato in the Sistine Chapel Choir.
There just one tape recording at the very end
Moreschi.
Of the castrati and the very beginning of recording technology?
Yes, we have one, and it's very hard to tell what it's about, but that's the castrato. That was in Italian church at the turn of the century.
Now, meanwhile, today we have something called a countertenor.
Mm. Yes, and I must say in the Santa Fe production, it's a real coup that we have David Daniels, who is a countertenor, coming to sing the role of Radamisto. So Radamisto now has gone from a soprano in the very first performances to a castrato, and then is sung by all sorts of voices. And today we will have here in Santa Fe David Daniels, a countertenor. This was a singer who started out, wanted to be a singer. He had a tenor voice, but he wasn't making it as a tenor. And one day he was fooling around and singing different things and found that, yes, he had no problem shifting into this upper range.
So a countertenor is somebody who sings higher than the
it's
tenor?
It's an extended range.
Is it a falsetto?
Yeah, that's one of the debates. I mean, the Grove Dictionary of Music, which is my Bible for all of this information, doesn't make it clear. And there's arguments whether it's a falsetto voice or not, whether it's still a natural voice, but up in that higher range. It sounds very like a woman's voice. And our next selection is actually going to be with David Daniels. So you'll get to hear it and playing it against Joyce DiDonato. You get a sense of how close it is. It's the mezzo alto range that can be very beautiful. Let me read you what David Daniels himself said about this. He says, I don't think my voice is feminine, though I understand that is probably the best way to describe it. Anyone watching me produce the sound does, I'm sure, pick up on an essentially masculine quality. Right now, I want to do more music that is not typically associated with the countertenor voice and do it well. I think it is imperative to have contemporary composers write for us as a voice type. We're here to stay. And that's becoming more and more apparent. There are new operas being written with countertenor roles. One of the characters in Thomas Addis' The Tempest we saw a couple of years back was a countertenor role. But traditionally, they're still heard in the Baroque operas. That's where you would expect to find this voice.
Now, when a contemporary opera is written for countertenor roles, do the composers sometimes have a particular vocalist in mind?
Yes, this is still fairly common. A lot of the early operas were written specifically for specific singers. Susanna in The Marriage of Figaro comes to mind. The singer that Mozart wanted to sing that role didn't have a lot of great top notes, high notes, so she doesn't sing in the top of the soprano range. In fact, very often she can be sung by a mezzo-soprano for that reason. So yes, you find a singer and create the role for that singer. Kaya Sarriahu, whose work we've talked about, composed a lot of music, L'Amour de Loin, that opera, for instance, for Dawn Upshaw. So in this case, yes, today singers will have specific roles composed for them. Another good example is the First Emperor by Tan Dun. Their role of the emperor was specifically composed for Placido Domingo. And actually for Placido Domingo as he is now, with the richness of the lower part of his tenor voice, bordering on the baritone. So, yes, it's specifically written. These were across the board, the castrati roles that many singers shared, of course. So the example I have of David Daniels, he hasn't, I don't think, recorded anything from Radamisto. And the aria I'd like to play is from Julius Caesar in Egypt. It's a classic virtuoso aria about a soldier ready to take up arms. And it's a good example, I think, of the beauty of David Daniels' voice. And he is a countertenor.
Quest'alma che viene, vendetta va, quest'alma che viene, all'ampo di darmi quest'alma che viene, vendetta va, all'ampo di darmi.
So that is a different sound, isn't it?
It is indeed.
Yes,
it,
that's the sound of the countertenor David Daniels, who will sing Radamisto this summer at the Santa Fe Opera in the Opera by Handel. It's a little disconcerting the first time you see a countertenor, because he's probably dressed as a man, but there's this woman-like voice. You know, it's actually easier to listen to than watch, but once you get over it, even the singers he has sung with said, you know, it's a different voice, but I forget that it's okay. You know, the sound is so fabulous. His control and his warmth, he's technically flawless, this David Daniels. It's great.
Now, one of the things about an opera like Radamisto by Handel is that when you're sitting in the Santa Fe Opera watching it and the little subtitles are flashing on the seat in front of you, you can follow the story. It's a little hard to tell the story in your book or on this particular radio program. But there's some things that are very important to talk about. For example, the next musical selection we're going to hear is a da capo aria. What is that? What is a da capo aria?
Yeah, this is the central focus of the Baroque style. It's the reason people flock to the theaters, because with a da capo aria, you get a little melody and it's repeated two or three times.
Now, da capo means from the
beginning. From the head, yes, yeah, from da capo head. And then there's a second verse, and then the third part goes back to the beginning. Da capo aria. So it's called an ABA form. You get verse A, verse B, and verse A comes back. The difference is that in the repeat, the singer can really go to town and show off what they can do, because this is full of ornamentation and embellishment. And there are marvelous stories from the time of Handel. Handel believed that music and song was what it was about, not production. It was about beautiful, great singing. And in a way, he sort of fell into his own trap, because the singers took this and decided they could do exactly what they liked with these arias. In fact, if a singer didn't like their aria when they went back to the A part the second time, they would have the composer rewrite it, or they go to another composer and have them write something special that had nothing to do with the original piece. So it would show off their voice and their incredible skills. And there's the marvelous story of the suitcase aria, where a specific singer would have a certain aria that showed off everything wonderful they could do. And everyone would flock to hear this one aria. They'd take it out of the suitcase at each new venue and sing that aria, regardless of whether it was a comedy or a tragedy, and just stick it in, and people went wild. it's a crazy thing that happened.
It's a really different role of the singer and of the composer. I mean, the singer had so you don't have divas now, but the diva could say, I want my aria rewritten.
Oh, yes, they call the shots, the castrati and the divas, and they got in terrible fights. You know, if one diva had a couple of notes longer than the castrato, there'd be a terrible fight. Two divas apparently got into a hair-pulling contest in the middle of one production because they didn't like what the other was doing. And if a castrato was on stage and somebody else was singing and he'd get bored, he'd go over to the stage box and talk to his friends. You know, it was unreal. It was definitely the day of the singer. Thank goodness those days have gone. By the time of Mozart wrote out these cadenzas, these embellishments, and the singer was supposed to follow them. Now today, it's interesting. I've talked to a number of singers on this. What do you do about the ornamentation, the trills and the runs and all of this stuff in the repeat? And they said, well, in some cases, it's worked out between the conductor and the singer. And sometimes the conductor makes the decision. So today, there's a collaboration. I mean, today, thank goodness, the day of the diva really is over. Opera today is a team effort that's quite astounding as I watch rehearsals. It doesn't matter how great the leading lady may be, or how small the smaller supernumerary, they are all part of an incredible team. That's, I think, part of the reason for opera success today. But in this case, they are still doing da capo aria. So maybe I could play you an example of a da capo aria. This one is from Polissena. The singer in this recording is Patrizia Chioffi. She's fabulous. And you'll hear the line, Barbaro, Patiro. She is now angry with her husband. She says, you're a barbarian, I'm leaving, and my love will turn to anger. Now, as you're watching the titles of this piece that might go on 10 minutes, you'll probably only get two or three lines on your titles. This is because the lines are sung over and over. And in the example I'm going to play you, you'll hear, listen carefully, you'll hear Barbaro, Partiro, repeated two or three times. And then there's a slightly different tune with that second verse. And then she will go back to the beginning, Barbaro, Partiro. You'll hear it again with a lot of wonderful embellishments. And this is done brilliantly by this particular soprano. So this is perhaps a good example of the da capo aria from the Baroque style.
Barbaro partiro, barbaro, barbaro partiro, la signora verrà, la signora verrà, l'amore congelerà tutta indirizza, l'amore congelerà tutta indirizza.
So that was an example of a da capo aria from the Baroque style. People,
and the ABA is very clear.
Yes, it is. It's very, you get the first verse, the second verse, then you go back to the first verse with a lot of embellishments and ornamentation. It's actually fairly simple. And once you've heard this two or three times, you want to hear it again and again. There's something a bit addictive to this music. So, and I think the way the Santa Fe Opera plan, from what I've seen of the designs, is going to be a thrilling piece to watch.
Now, we're going to cut to the glorious and happy reunion at the end of the of the opera.
Yes, Handel rarely leaves you in a tragic frame of mind. You bounce out of the theatre with this one. Everything gets resolved. Radamisto and Zenobio are reunited, and Polissena, for I can't imagine why, she goes back to her terrible husband, and they all dance the night away. And this next example is a little from the end. It's one of the rare cases where there is a duet, as Radamisto and Zenobio are reunited at the end of the opera. And that's the end of Radamisto by Handel, which the Santa Fe Opera will be presenting starting the 19th of July. So I hope to see everybody at this wonderful production.
And everybody lives happily ever after.
Yes, I do.
Before we leave, I thought we could talk about some of the, not only the operas themselves, but some of the many other things that the Santa Fe Opera is doing and how people can get involved in other ways than, as you put it, sitting in a seat.
Yes, I think this opera company and many opera companies around the country now have their own outreach and education departments that are doing magnificent work in terms of bringing opera and music to, for instance, the schools. It turns out that in this state, in New Mexico, there is a Fine Arts Education Act that says that all 89 school districts in the state of New Mexico should have some type of visual and performing arts program. The Act calls for school districts to work with community arts organizations to supplement the school programs. What that means is there typically is not in the budget money for arts, for music teachers, for teaching in the arts within the system. So in a way, actually, I think they do well because they turn to the arts organization. All of them do wonderful work. They go into the schools and on many different levels work with the kids, introducing them to the arts or to dance or to all of the arts. The symphony goes in. The Santa Fe Opera has what are called artists in residence, and they do student-produced operas in the schools, up to 25 student productions a year. I mean, that's a staggering amount when you think of the commitment. So an artist in the school will go in, work with a classroom or two classes, however many students they're given, and the kids actually develop their own operas. Now, in elementary schools.
That's amazing.
It's amazing. I didn't think this was possible. But when you think about it.
And you've got the little, you know, 9-year-old singers. And
yes, yes. And it works. I mean, kids are great for making up stories. We know that. So it's teaching collaboration, too. The kids get together. They come up with a story, okay? They decide this would be a good story for an opera. And then with a little help from the artist in residence, they decide what sort of music they'll have. And the music is matched to the words. They write a libretto, and then they start rehearsing. And then through the course of this whole project, everybody gets a job. Not everybody's going to be the leading lady, for instance, but they all do work. Some of them will work on their computers and design programs. Some of them will paint scenery. Some of them will make costumes. Everybody has a job. And at the end of this, they put together the most incredibly charming, wonderful little works. In fact, in 2006, a grant came to the Santa Fe Opera from the History Channel to help underwrite a little piece called The Fall of the Enemy, an opera created by Carlos Gilbert elementary school students and called Many Mountains Surrounding a World War II. It's all about a World War II internment camp for Japanese Americans located in Santa Fe.
Wow.
Now, that's a sort of tough subject, you'd think, but kids are should not surprise one. There is no subject they cannot handle. And if they have any sense of what went on here with those camps, Japanese Americans during the war, they're going to write about it. And
they'll never forget it.
They'll never forget it.
Now, moving on from children, We have Intermezzo, which is a group for people in their 20s and 30s.
Yes, for people then who graduate from these elementary schools and they're not maybe going to choose opera as their first way of having a night out with a date, or if they're singles. I mean, in many opera companies started these intermezzo young adult programs for people who wanted to meet other people with common interests. So intermezzo is one series of wonderful party nights, I promise you. They have wonderful parties before the operas. They go to the opera and they mix and match, and they can be couples or they can be singles. But it's been a very successful program. Out of this, they learn how to form a board and how to run a board and how to support the opera company. So, again, it's learning on many levels, where the school programs teach kids collaboration, working together, and dealing with some of these heavy subjects in a way that's not always easy to deal with. These are young adults who can contribute as well.
And just briefly, there's a Pueblo Opera program and there's Youth Night.
Youth Night is when two of the dress rehearsals this year, it'll be Falstaff on June 23rd and Marriage of Figaro on June 24th, where an adult can bring a minimum of two children or they can bring many children, and they are absolutely dirt cheap tickets, the group tickets, and you call the box office for these. This is a fabulous way of families going to the opera, of bringing the kids, and the Pueblo Opera program has always been a part of this. All the Native American kids are exposed to opera, and I'll never forget going to my first youth night and seeing all these Native American families with their blankets, and the kids sleep through half of it, but most of it they love. And actually Native American children relate very easily to opera. They have no trouble with costumes and masks and dance and ritual. Our kids have a much harder time with that.
So
that's fascinating. So if people are interested in that, they should call the box office to find. It's very reasonable, and we really encourage people to bring kids. I brought my children about this age, elementary school age, to the Barber of Seville, and you know, they were so absorbed that to this day they can sing most of that opera.
Desiree Mays is an international storyteller and lecturer on opera, the author of Opera Unveiled. She speaks nightly at the Santa Fe Opera during the season, which opens this year on the 27th of June. The number is 505-986-5900. Or from out of area, 800-280-4654. And the Santa Fe Opera is on the web at santafeopera.org. Desiree, it's been wonderful doing this opera series with you. Thank you so much.
It's been fun.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can reach me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at the website santaferadiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Marilyn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the Colors of Jazz.